The following lecture is under copyright by Reformation Christian Ministries and is for your personal use only. It is not to be copied or otherwise distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. Contact information will be provided at the end of this lecture.
This is Lecture Roman Numeral 3 in our series on New Testament Textual Criticism, A Reformation Approach for the 21st Century. And on this lecture we want to begin with the subject of the papyrus witnesses. Kurt Alland, as we have already noted, had been allocated the task of assigning official reference numbers to manuscripts and fragments of the Greek New Testament. Here's an interesting and informative point to ponder. Alland fought a bitter academic battle with yet another German textual critic, this time Carsten Theodor, over a tiny papyrus fragment which is now known as Papyrus 7Q5. This fragment was discovered in Wadi Qumran and is part of what are known as the Dead Sea Scrolls. It contains just a single Greek word, the copulative kai, and six partial Greek words. Scholars, including the Spanish papyriologist José O'Callaghan, were able, by expanding the torn-away parts of the words, and from the position on the fragment and its relation between the surviving letters, to identify this as a tiny scrap from Mark's Gospel. Actually, Mark chapter 6, verses 52-54, of which the complete portion in English would read, "They considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their hearts were hardened. And when they had passed over, they came into the land of Gennesaret, and drew to the shore. And when they were come out..." And that's where the fragment breaks off. It's an astonishing find. But Alland refused to recognize this fragment, or to include it in his official list of New Testament papyri. You'll find no reference to it at all in Alland and Alland's definitive The Text of the New Testament book, even down to the latest 1995 edition. See the Index of Manuscripts, Papyri, page 345 of that book. Nor will you find any citation of the text, Mark 6, 52-54. See the Index of Biblical Citations on pages 338-344 of that book. The resulting Alland-Theodor controversy went on from 1976 until at least 1984. Carsten Theodor began an exhaustive study of this and of other Cave 7 papyrus fragments, finally writing a definitive book, The Earliest Gospel Manuscript, in 1992. For comparison, a similar small papyrus fragment was discovered in Egypt, which also contained one complete Greek word, edu, and six fragmentary words. It was possible, by the same methodology, to identify this as a fragment of the Greek poet Menander from his Samia, lines 385-390. Historians were delighted. No one questioned the attribution or refused to accept it. Take another example, more remarkable still. In Herod's hill fort and palace at Masada, the scene of the Jewish zealot's last stand against Rome, was found during excavation a group of small papyrus fragments containing writing. Interestingly, the language was not Greek, not Aramaic, but Latin, a majuscule or capital letter script written without breaks or punctuation. It had two letters, then a gap, two letters, then a gap, then a line of 11 letters. In time, this was identified as a quote from the Roman poet Virgil, the Aeneid, Book 4, Chapter 9, and expanded as follows. Anna, Sora, quae mi suspensam insomnia tirent. No one can say whether Herod and his court were readers of Virgil in Latin, or whether the fragment originated in the portable library of a Roman soldier or officer temporarily stationed at Masada after its fall. But the identification, reconstructed from so few letters, was never questioned, but accepted by the scholarly community. Why, then, the controversy over the Mark fragment from the Dead Sea? The style of lettering, paleography, and other indications, plus the generally accepted archaeological consensus that all Dead Sea fragments were deposited before the end of the First Jewish Revolt in AD 70-71, mandated that this fragment be of that date at the latest, that is, well within the lifetime of many of the apostles and of Christians who knew and saw and heard Jesus. But it is exactly as the text that underlies our Bible today. Where, we ask, is the time for these floated reminiscences to form source material, and then an Ur-Gospel to be evolved from them, and finally be turned into Mark's Gospel as we know it? Could it be that a random quote from an early source fragment had been carried down verbatim and absolutely unchanged from Q to U to the traditional Mark? It's not very likely, surely. Finds like this completely unhinge the scholarly theories on the evolution of the text of the New Testament. Also, Alland believed and taught that all Christian writings belong to the period when book form codices were already the fashion, and so to him there just should not be any Christian scrolls at all. Let's consider also the three fragments of the Magdalene Papyrus P64, sent to Magdalene College in Oxford in 1901 by Charles Hewlett, the Anglican chaplain of Luxor in Egypt. These have been recently redated on stylistic and paleographic grounds to be as early as AD 60-66, and they're identified as containing texts from Matthew's Gospel, as follows. Fragment 1, verso, or front, is Matthew 26:7-8. Fragment 2, verso, Matthew 26:10. Fragment 3, verso, Matthew 26:14-15. Coming back in the reverse order, on the other side of the fragments, fragment 3, recto, or back, Matthew 26:22-23. Fragment 2, recto, Matthew 26:31. Fragment 1, recto, Matthew 26:32-33. Or, in English, poured it on his head as he sat at meat. But when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, and then there's a break. Jesus understood it. He said unto them, why trouble ye the woman? For she has wrought a good work upon me. And there's a break. One of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went unto the chief priests and said unto them, what will you give me? And there's a break. And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and began every one to say unto him, Lord, is it I? And he answered and said, he that dippeth his hand with me in the dish. And there's a break. Then said Jesus unto them, all you shall be offended because of me this night. For it is written, and there's another break, I will go before you into Galilee. Peter answered and said unto him, and here it finishes. So here's a scrap of Matthew's Gospel, of apostolic date, when many witnesses would still be alive to refute anything untrue or sensational, or added by tradition, or by a developing Jesus myth, or whatever, detailing the Last Supper and the preparations for Christ's betrayal. And again, the Greek wording is almost identical with later and modern printed Greek texts. Now, these tiny fragments of extremely early gospel copies are not cited as evidence for the received or majority text type, as opposed to the reconstructed eclectical text types. Indeed, they're too tiny to help in any such dispute. But rather, they're cited to show that written gospels existed, of which these tiny fragments can fit precisely into later copies, and that they existed as early as 65 to 70 AD, thus leaving no historical period for the evolution of Q's or U's. The evidence is that our written Gospels, and therefore by analogy all of our New Testament literature, is as early as it purports to be, and therefore must have been written by the very men it says it was written by. For if Mark, or Luke, or Peter, or John was alive, how might anyone, with whatever intention, forge writings in their name and be undetected? But Alan, as we've seen, belonged to a very different school of thought, to say the least, and it's not surprising to find that he fought to discredit these fragments. He refers to the Magdalene Papyrus 5 times in his New Testament book, but writes of it as a 3rd century production, page 159, and of about 200 AD, page 157, keeping even to the very latest edition of the book to this late dating, which has been completely discredited by Tierda's work. This is not personally to attack him, just to emphasise that his presuppositions and conclusions were very far removed from a reformed and inspired and preserved text position. Our question then is, can a teacher whose theories are so diametrically opposed to all of our reformed understanding indeed be allowed to teach us what is and what is not part of our Bibles? To settle the very text of the Gospels and of the rest of the New Testament for us. His settled conviction about the nature and origin and inspiration and preservation of the text is destructive of its inspiration and unique nature, as the Reformed faith understands that. The Reformed faith demands Reformed scholars and Reformed textual critics, and Bibles that are produced according to the Bible's own internal testimony, by hands that respect that inner authority. They are not hard to find, but we have ignored them, turned aside to our moderns, and done so with destructive results. And a last word on papyrus evidence. Wilbur Pickering comments that, quote, "In Hort's day, the early papyri were not extant. Had they been, the Westcott and Hort theory could never have appeared," unquote. That's Pickering on The Identity of the New Testament Text, page 224. A.F.J. Klein compared the papyri fragments for text type, where there is a recognisable difference, with Aleph and B on the one hand, and the majority received readings on the other. This he did in a survey of the researches into the Western text of the Gospels. It's important, in view of the massive weight put upon antiquity and the earliest witnesses, to remember that Aleph and B date to the 4th century, with Aleph probably 50 to 75 years later than B, whilst the majority of the papyri date from the 2nd century. Also, most papyrus texts come from Egypt, and so would be expected to agree with the so-called Alexandrian text type if Aleph and B really do represent a genuine textual type or family current in Egypt, rather than just 2 very corrupted copies. And that text type should be apparent in Egyptian papyri antedating Aleph and B, if they truly represent a type older and nearer to the autographs. In fact, Klein's collation of these Egyptian papyri revealed that, and I quote, "the Textus Receptus has more early papyrus attestation than B, and twice as much as Aleph." Evidently, the Textus Receptus reflects an earlier text type than either Aleph or B, unquote. And that, of course, is Egypt itself. The quotation is from Pickering, The Identity of the New Testament Text, pages 55 to 56 and 220. Before we move on, let's just again have a final word on the canon. As we've seen, we have to consider questions of canon before we can home in on difficulties in the text. Because one, whole books are the major aspect of the canon, and books may be omitted as uncanonical, just as text-critical questions deal with the minor canon, whereby sections and phrases and words have also been expelled on the accusation of being extra or non-canonical. Two, that some of the very same scholars and authorities who produce the critical and now near-standard texts of the New Testament, Nestle Aland United Bible Societies, are the same scholars who have as critical a view of the major canon as they do of the minor, and equally seek to rediscover and finalize the canon as they do the text within the books. We need now simply to replace all of this deep and basically rational reasoning, in case any student might have had his faith in the canon shaken, as he may already have had his faith in the preserved text undermined, by a far simpler and more God-honouring definition of the canon, and why the 27 New Testament books, no less and no more, are the true canon. It's simpler because it comes from within our own circle, and operates within our own presuppositions, and it's refreshing to get back onto our own side of the fence, is it not? Then we can come closer to the criticism of the text, certain that the books or canon that contain that text are indeed the genuine ones. Here's a quote. "Let it be shown that the books were written by the men whose names they bear, and that there is reason for believing that the authors wrote under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and the evidence for the canonicity of the books is complete." Unquote. That's from Professor Joseph Angus, Bible Handbook, 1861, page 75. And it's that simple. Unless you are willing to believe that the Gospels evolved and were later attributed to the early apostles. And Aland dates the process as complete by the second half of the second century. Problem of the Canon, page 20. And inspiration may be denied to some epistles, but suggested for extra-biblical material. Angus goes on to add, quote, "As part of the evidence, in some sense a subordinate part, the claims and character of the books supply the chief evidence. It may be added that the books which now form the canon were read from the first in Christian assemblies as of divine authority." And he goes on to quote 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 to 2, and 1 John chapter 4, verse 1. "That ecclesiastical authors quote largely from them, and that they constituted the canonical books of the early church." Unquote. In other words, the books are self-attesting and were recognized as such from the very earliest days. Some of the books indeed took a little longer to be fully accepted in certain parts of the church, and other works were referred to for edification. But there is no evidence that any but our 27 New Testament books were ever promoted as being inspired. All were recognized by some major part of the Orthodox Church, and all doubts lingering over certain books in certain areas ceased before 400 AD, in all areas. Eusebius lists James and Jude, 2 Peter and 3 John, and Revelation as being doubted by some. But that indicates they were in with but a few lingering doubters, and Eusebius himself was by no means orthodox. Whilst the canons of Athanasius, Epiphanius, Augustine, and the Third Council of Carthage, and the editor of the works of Dionysius the Areopagite, all agree exactly with our present canon. We simply argue that if the books of the canon are self-attesting, and the primitive church speedily recognised them, then of necessity the text within those books is equally self-attesting, and has been equally recognised from those early days. It's a logical whole, preserved by God, and acknowledged by the church as the church's text and canon. It's something that was never subject to evolution, loss, or rediscovery by scholars. And the Reformed have traditionally, and in their greatest days, always been on that correct side of the antithesis. We have never admitted that neutral scholarship can determine the canon, and until recently have equally denied it any right to determine the true text within the canon. And of course, a church, an ecclesiastical canon, demands an ecclesiastical text. And the professing church has had such a text, in manuscript and in printed versions, from early antiquity, unquestioned until around 1880. Was there any good reason for the change from that date onwards? So we must now move on to consider what we'll call two arguments for change. The argument that underlies popular acceptance of the new, recently reconstructed, eclectic texts, and the basis on which most currently taught textual criticism stands, really has just two supports or givens, from which assumptions everything proceeds, on which two foundations everything is built. And these are, 1, the received text, and so Bibles made from it, were translated from a very narrow textual base. Many Greek texts have come to light since the days of the Reformation, offering a far wider choice of possible text variants and types, so we need our modern scholarship to decide amongst them. And 2, the scholarship of that period was limited and primitive, that is, in the days when the received text was first adopted and supported. We have advanced a lot since those days. We'll briefly look at each of these two claims, still with the intention of clearing the ground and levelling the playing field, before we can come to the core of our lectures on criticism proper. So 1. There are many more Greek manuscripts and evidence available now than were available in the 16th century. And we answer, yes, certainly. Here are some facts and some history. There are many more Greek manuscripts available now than there were at the Reformation, and also many other witnesses in early translations, quotations, etc., that have been identified since that date. Erasmus printed the first Greek Testament in Basel in 1516. The Complutensian Polyglot of the Roman Catholic Cardinal Ximenes was completed in 1514, but not printed until 1522. Various editions of each of these were issued in Antwerp and Geneva between 1571 and 1628. In 1534, the French printer Simon Collinius printed a Greek Testament in Paris using both Erasmus and the Complutensian texts. So completely did those agree, although they were composed in different countries, employing different manuscript bases. Collinus's stepson was Robert Estienne, 1503-1559, usually called Stephens or Stephanus, and he published New Testament editions in 1546, 1549, 1550, and 1551 in Paris, before moving on to Geneva, whilst Theodore Beza in Geneva issued editions of Stephens's text, with very slight modifications from manuscripts that he personally had collated, in 1565, 1567, 1580, 1582, 1588, 1598, and 1604. It was these Beza editions up to 1604 that underlie the English authorised version of 1611, whilst the very slightly different pre-Beza editions underlie the Geneva Bible of 1560. Very nearly identical editions were published by Bonaventura and Abraham Elsevier in Leiden, Holland, in 1624, 1633, and 1641. It was the preface to their 1633 edition which told the reader that he had in his hands the text always and everywhere received. Textus ergo habis, nunc ab omnibus receptum. This gave rise to the phrase receive text. So we should note that the phrase itself actually postdates the issue of the King James Bible in English. Erasmus, the Complutensian polyglot, the Stephens and Beza and Elsevier editions, all are nearly identical, with just the occasional word being different, and some spelling and minor etymological matters differing. All are made up from a very small and limited text base. And Beza's minor modifications represent a slightly wider examination of copies than Erasmus or Jimenez, although we have no way of determining and knowing just how many manuscripts were in fact available and collated to these scholars. Differences amongst the underlying manuscripts, and thus between the printed texts, are little more than punctuation and spelling matters. In effect, these various Textus Receptus texts may be said to be, for all essential purposes, identical. By the mid-20th century, we had, as mentioned in the previous lecture, 267 majuscules or uncials, 2,764 minuscules or cursives, 81 papyrus manuscript fragments, and quotations preserved in lectionaries and other early church writings to the number of 2,143, making a sum total of all witnesses to the Greek New Testament as 5,255. According to Alland himself, the percentage of minuscules or cursives belonging to what he calls the Byzantian, that is, the received text type, is about 90%, say 2,450 out of 2,764. This is quoted by him in his work Die Konsequenzen der neuen Handschriftfunde für die neutestamentliche Textkritik, April 1967, in Novum Testamentum, page 100. Among the surviving majuscules or uncials, which are regarded as generally earlier and more to be relied upon, according to Bruce Metzger, over 50% also support the traditional text. This is Metzger, The Text of the New Testament, pages 42-61. Adding papyri and early quotations, it is estimated that there's at the very least 80%, and possibly as high as just over 90%, of all surviving witnesses support a Byzantine or received text base, where there are noticeable differences. So we agree that vastly more witnesses are available now than were available when the received text was collated and printed. And we note that the overwhelming consensus of all of this more recently identified and collated material lines up right behind that same textual type. In other words, Erasmus and Beza made a relatively small trawl of material from a far wider pool, but so homogeneous is the material within that pool that their sample was nevertheless an accurate representation of the whole. But how often are we told that the reformers made a text from a small, narrow, limited textual base, with no further explanation given to us at all? 2. The next claim is that we understand far more about manuscript types and families, have a far wider variety of text types to consider, than had the reformers, and this requires a higher level of scholarship to decide properly amongst them. Well, this looks plausible, but only if the nature of the more recent material is not explained. If 80 to 90% is almost identical, bar the odd word, or spelling matters, or a very few larger discrepancies, and only 10 to 20% dissents, then we have not a whole range and variety of manuscript types or families to choose from. We have the majority and a very small minority. And the task, logically, is to account for the deviance of the minority. Again, very many textbooks and articles blur this issue. We see diagrams showing trees with the trunk being the long-lost autograph copies, and then branches springing out from them, and smaller branches from these, with all the text variants, and given names like the Western branch, the Caesarean branch, the Alexandrian branch, etc. And we're told how scribal errors were blindly copied onwards, producing now smaller branches, and then smaller variants of those, and so on and so forth. We say that such diagrams are fundamentally wrong and misleading. It's a very strange tree that would have 80 to 90% of its strength in just one great branch, with just perhaps tiny twigs of spelling and orthography differences, and this all on one side, and just 10 to 20% in two differing branches and a couple of slight twigs on the other. The two small branches are B. Vaticanus and Aleph Sinaiticus, and the twigs make up their maximum of 20%, and these are papyrus P75 and random readings from other copies and papyri. And these alone represent what has been called the Alexandrian text type, although included in that percentage must be a small number of texts that are of what has been called a mixed type, and so are elevated themselves with the title of neutral or Caesarean text type. That massive branch, with just twigs of variety, is the Byzantine, or majority, or ecclesiastical, or traditional, or received text. If we need scholarship, it should be aimed at the question of how those couple of odd lopsided branches grew, and what that tells us about the history of the text. And here's another myth. The best manuscripts are amongst those that have been discovered since the Textus Receptus was printed. Now, best, in modern textual critics speak, always means oldest. We'll examine that claim and see how illogical it is later on. Modern eclectic texts are based upon just two ancient majuscule manuscripts, Aleph Sinaiticus and B. Vaticanus. Sinaiticus was discovered in a monastery by Constantine Tischendorf in 1859. Before this date, Tischendorf had issued 7 critical Greek New Testaments, declaring each time that the last was so correct that it would never need replacing. Then he discovered Aleph, and issued another version incorporating 3,572 changes from his previously declared unchangeable edition. You can see that recorded in Bergen and Miller, the traditional text, page 7. Sinaiticus, despite Tischendorf's initial enthusiasm, has been employed mainly as a support, a prop, for Vaticanus B, and Vaticanus, the older of these two texts, is that which really and essentially underlies all modern versions and eclectic, reconstructed Greek testaments. But Vaticanus was known and consulted long before the Reformation. Roman Catholic Cardinal Jimenez and his scholar Stunica certainly had access to it, and even Protestant scholars were not denied access to it until comparatively recent times, when it began to be feared that their constant handling was damaging a holy relic. The so-called Alexandrian text type, represented by B. Vaticanus, was known to the scholars who printed the earliest Greek texts, but none seriously considered it as anything but an interesting and very deviant survival. So, 1. The mass of newly collated material from the Reformation to date actually supports the received text. And 2. The text type now called Alexandrian was well known, through one of its two greatest representatives, the best and the oldest of the two at that, because that was in the Vatican Library. But neither Roman Catholic nor Protestant scholars allowed it any weight at all in determining the true text of the New Testament. So next we need to cut through this fog and confusion by looking at the issue of what we'll call comparative scholarship. If the Reformation and later scholars, down to the beginning of the 19th century at least, had a smaller textual base to collate and compare, but that text base was in fact perfectly representative of the mass of text discovered and examined later, and if the main dissenting or radically different text, B. Vaticanus, was at least somewhat known and understood, but afforded no weight against the mass of fairly homogeneous manuscripts, we are left with the question of the comparative quality of the scholars. The Reformers and the Puritans and their successors, 1550 to 1800 approximately, those who gave attention to text matters, versus the moderns, from Lachmann, Tischendorf, Trigellus, Westcott and Hort, down to Metzger and Alland and their followers today, the period 1800 to 2000, with a real impact only from about 1880, with the advent of the English Revised Version following the eclectic text devised by Westcott and Hort. Says Mark Knoll, quote, "Text criticism problems have long been set to rest among academically qualified conservatives," unquote. That's his Between Faith and Criticism, Harper and Row, 1986, page 117. Note among academically qualified conservatives. If you do not subscribe to the eclectic texts, then you must be theologically subliterate, academically naive. If we're not to be intimidated by such language, let's instead look at the facts. How goes the comparison? Is the newest scholarship necessarily the best? Were those ancient men so primitive in their scholarship and their learning? Who shall we trust when we ourselves are not and cannot be first-rate linguists and antiquarians? Who shall we trust the people under our ministries to when we recommend a Bible version made from one text type or the other? When the King James Bible was produced in 1611, it was, of course, not a new translation, direct from the Hebrew and the Greek. This is because there was already a standard Bishop's Bible in English and the popular Geneva translation of 1560. Both of these relied heavily on the work of William Tyndale, 1494 to 1536, and the intention was rather to make a good translation better. Nevertheless, a highly powered group of advisers was assembled, probably second only to the great Westminster Assembly of Divines. They were to check the translation from the original languages, improve readings, and compare and criticise each other's work. Remember that these men were aware of Vaticanus and of other minor textual variants, but they did not dream of amending the text by so eccentric a document. This company included the famous Dr. Lancelot Andrews and 30 other men who held doctor's degrees, including two who held professorships of Hebrew at Oxford University, four who held professorships of Hebrew at Cambridge University, three who held professorships of Greek at Cambridge, and two who held professorships of Divinity at Cambridge, one who held professorship of Divinity at Oxford, whilst another compiled a 7-volume biblical heptaglot. We need also to remember the period in which all of this took place. These were not only Reformation men, but Renaissance men, a period of immense attention to learning of all kinds. These reputations were not gained lightly. Can we imagine that such men would not be aware of deviant or heretical Greek texts, could not properly weigh the manuscript evidence, remembering again that later evidence simply deepens massively the manuscript base available then, 80-90%, or that these men thought the antiquity of Vaticanus was any real recommendation? And here is just a small insight into how thoroughly they went about their task. Dr. Richard Kilby records how a single Greek word was considered for translation, with 3 reasons proposed for a particular rendering in English. And after a full consideration, 13 more reasons were advanced, supporting the translation finally adopted. That's an insight into the great lengths these hugely learned men went over each and every word of the original and then in English. All of these men were Protestants and Reformed in doctrine. All this scholarship on our own side of the antithesis. Nor were there lacking scholars in the Reformed community who were not on these committees, who dissented from the King James Bible and wanted a better or revised version almost at once. Henry Ainsworth translated the Pentateuch and the Song of Solomon for his commentary, believing that he could do better than the King James Version men. Hugh Broughton advocated a new translation as early as 1593, and he bitterly criticised the King James Version when it appeared in 1611. He is said to have been a learned, if eccentric, scholar, and he left translations of much of the Bible, which were published in his works edited by John Lightfoot in 1662. Ambrose Usher, elder brother of the famed Archbishop James Usher, completed an entire Bible translation about the same time as King James's men were doing their work, and the manuscript of that was said to have been still preserved in the library of University College Dublin as late as 1837. And the noted Baptist Puritan Henry Jesse worked on a complete new translation of his own. Of Jesse it is said, quote, "Biblical criticism was his principal study. He acquired a great proficiency in Hebrew and rabbinical law. A work in which his soul was engaged was no less than the making of a new and more correct translation of the Holy Bible. The Hebrew and Greek testaments he carried about with him, but notwithstanding his qualifications in this respect, he had not the vanity to think such a work fit for any single man, and therefore sent letters to many learned men of this and of other nations, desiring their assistance and joint labours with him in this great design. Many persons of great note for their learning did engage upon it." Unquote. Henry Jesse's translation was complete, and waiting for examiners to approve it for printing, in 1660, when King Charles II returned, and persecution of all things Puritan began. There is not a hint that these Protestant and Reformed scholars, with their helpers on the continent of Europe, however critical they were of the King James Version in English, ever thought of rejecting or changing the underlying Greek texts. Surely they had the materials, and they had the learning to do so, if they saw any logical or good reason to do that. In the next lecture, we will continue this argument with an examination of the great English Puritan, John Owen.
This lecture is copyrighted by Reformation Christian Ministry, the parent organization of Reformation International Theological Seminary and Reformation International College. This audio lecture is protected under international copyright law and is not to be copied, distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. You may contact Reformation Christian Ministries through our website at www.reformation.edu, by email at president@reformation.edu, by phone in the U.S., at 772-571-8833, or by writing to Reformation Christian Ministries, 13950 122 Street, Fellsmere, Florida, 32948, USA. Thank you.